Het is een boek dat eigenlijk een sociologisch boek is, een studie over hoe dat mensen tegenwoordig schrik worden aangejaagd voor van alles en nog wat. Schrik over dingen die in vlees zitten, schrik over dingen die in eten zitten, schrik over mensen met problemen die dus dringend in therapie moeten. Eigenlijk schrik voor alles. En dit heeft Frank Faridi onderzocht. Welcome, Mr. Faridi.
It's a pleasure, thank you.
The first thing when I got your book, I was shocked by the title. I thought, well, culture of fear? Yeah. Is there a culture of fear?
Well, every culture has something very different to say about fear. And the thing that I've noticed is if you look at Western culture, it's more and more based upon the fear metaphor. Mm-hmm. So, for example, people are continually reminded that their health is in danger. They're told that it's not safe to walk in the streets. We're told that there are too many immigrants coming in here. We're told that children mustn't be left on their own because they're going to be kidnapped. Mm-hmm. And what I argue in the book is that virtually every human experience now comes with a health warning.
Yeah. And the thing is, while reading your book, it started to dawn on me that you actually had a point. because, and that's what I also noticed in your previous interview with the Dutch guy, that he also said, well, while reading your book, all of a sudden there is a shift in your mind and you start noticing things better. For instance, when I was a child, when I was 11 years old, I was allowed from my parents to cycle from here, from Antwerp to the coast.
Yes.
With one of my best friends.
Yes.
And quite recently I told someone and he said, nah, you're lying.
Yes.
It's impossible to cycle 100 miles when you're 11, just the two of you.
Yeah.
You're lying. It's a myth. You've been dreaming this. He said, no, it's true.
Yeah.
And the people wouldn't believe me because they said, well, if we were the parents, we would never have allowed you to do that.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, this is the point you're trying to make. People are afraid of things. They're afraid of risks. Taking risks, natural risks, risks which are part of natural growth, growing older, becoming an adult, growing up, taking a career move, whatever. And you say that somehow there is this sneaky thing that's going through our bodies and minds and say, no, we shouldn't be doing this anymore.
That's right. I think you raise a very interesting point because there are so many things in life that you could do 20 years ago that you can no longer do today, that you almost forgot that this was a natural thing to do. And, you know, you give the example of bicycling 100 kilometers, which was quite normal for children in those days. But there are many examples. Earlier on, I was talking to people, telling them that when I was a university student, we all used to hitchhike around Europe. And that was a normal way of getting around, very cheap, nice way of transportation.
Mm.
Whereas today, for example, in England, nobody does that anymore because they think it's very, very dangerous and very, very scary. And when you look at life, you find that increasingly we've become much more circumscribed in what we do. Our area of public life becomes more and more constrained, and we become also very hesitant. Human relationships are also the same. You know, instead of welcoming strangers,
mm-hmm.
and saying, well, it's a stranger, it's very interesting, we think of strangers as dangerous, you know, and therefore become much more wary of interacting with them.
Yeah. And what I've also noticed through reading your book was that in a way we seem to be, and that's what you're trying to point out, that people seem to be aware that everything has been contaminated before. Or it's contaminating you, it's contaminating public life, personal life, relationships. And it's all used with the metaphor of virus. You've got viral marketing, you've got relationships which are affected by relational viruses. So everything's becoming endemic, epidemic, it's contagious.
Yeah.
And that's what you describe. Now, do you see whether there is any kind of root cause for this? Is there a reason for this? Is it just a social trend, development?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons for it. The most important reason is that we no longer believe that human beings are essentially responsible, sensible, or good. And instead of looking at the great things that people can do and are constructive, positive, creative side, we tend to think of human beings as being, by and large, negative. And in the English language, we talk about the human impact on the environment, which I think is a very interesting idea, because when we use that term, the human impact on the environment, we always use it negatively. You know, it's a negative impact, whereas the idea that somehow humans can impact on the environment in a way that is positive and is creative and is to the good, that's just somehow is not something that we're prepared to accept. So when human beings are seen in such pessimistic, destructive way, it's not at all surprising that we're not just afraid of others, we're afraid of ourselves.
Yeah. So, and you find that this is a vein running through our social life, and it's a sort of fatalistic approach to life, to human beings. You also quote, or you say that it's basically anti-humanistic. It's the opposite of humanism, because humanism actually believes in the human capacities of to grow, to develop things, to deal with challenges, with problems. And somehow things have shifted. But is there a real reason for this? Is it because of our culture? Is it have we become too rich?
I don't think we've become too rich, because you could argue that if you become prosperous, it gives you more time to do great things and to be creative. But instead, we've become attached to a narrative of humanity which is almost pre-modern. It's almost a bit like going back to the old religious days when we believed that we suffer from some kind of original sin, and that, you know, whatever we do is going to get worse and worse. And what happens as a result of that is that as human beings are continually defined downwards, the humanistic model, which was very important, becomes more and more marginal. And if you look, go to a bookshop, you'll find that more and more books are written in an anti-humanist way, and more and more books question the special qualities of humanity.
Yeah.
And regard human beings as almost parasites on this world, rather than anything else.
Yeah, and everybody seems to be ill or sick in the head, or everything seems to be wrong. Just now, I walked through the different bookstands, and I noticed there was half a table, I think about 20 books, dealing with autistic people.
Yeah,
like how to deal with autistic children, how to deal with autistic youngsters. What if your parents are autistic? So everyone seems to be autistic, and it's quite a topical thing, because right now there is this big thing, how do you call it? There is, you know, maybe you have heard about it, there's this guy, a young guy, he was 18, who shot some people, a Turkish woman, a white child with her nanny, and the nanny was black. But now it's a trial. And one of the first things that the people of the defendants say that is probably the guy was autistic.
Yes.
As a kind of excuse for a blatant racist killing of people. Yeah. So everything seems to be infected by this idea that, well, right now everyone is slightly autistic, and if you don't really, really confess or come out that you're also slightly autistic, people don't take you for granted anymore.
Yeah, I think what you're describing is the medicalization of
human
life.
It's part of your book as well.
And I think what's interesting is that every child gets a diagnosis very early on. So if you misbehave a little bit, you're told that you got attention deficit syndromes. If you're shy, you're told you got social phobia. You know, if you're inarticulate, then you're autistic. You know, so if you got a problem reading a book, then you're dyslexic. So when you think of all the new diagnostic labels that we have, you get to the point at which being ill is normal, and we have the normalization of illness, or what I call the diseasing of everyday life. And I think what that basically means is that we now regard ourselves as a very weak, vulnerable human beings who cannot cope with reality, and therefore we're entitled to be scared all the time, because we haven't got the emotional, moral, intellectual resources to cope with new challenges.
Yeah, everyone is seen as a victim.
More or less, yeah, victim of something. Yes,
everyone is victimized.
Yes, that's right. And it's interesting, because you even get to the point where very powerful, rich people, you know, sort of often come out and flaunt their victim status.
Yeah,
it becomes a badge of honor that you use to construct your identity. If you go on the internet, what I find very interesting is that here's this wonderful new technology, but no sooner do we use the internet than we talk about internet abuse, internet addiction, internet viruses, internet pedophiles. It's almost like we turn this technology into a tool that victimizes us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's basically a misanthropic view on the world, on people. Everything is possibly bad or negative.
I think that's the scariest thing, that throughout human history, people have always argued that either human nature is good or bad. There would be big debates as to what we were. These days, it's very difficult to find accounts of human nature that are either saying human nature is good or is potentially good. And I think instead what we have is an attempt to hold back the human potential, to denounce people who are ambitious or who have dreams or who want to experiment.
Yeah.
I noticed, for example, if you go on Google and you put in human experimentation, you don't get the discovery of a medicine. You get Frankenstein or you get
Holocaust.
Some kind of Holocaust. Or
Mengele.
Exactly. That's that's what you get. It's seen as essentially a destructive thing rather than a positive thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and the worst thing, and that's the sort of the thing I derived from your book, from reading your book, is that we can't help it. Because if we would like to tackle something, we will have to tackle invisible things. Like, and then again, I had this sudden memory flash of actually driving 5 miles an hour in Brussels, and I had to stop because someone stopped with a car, and I just hit the guy in front of me just very slightly. The guy came out and started to panic, almost hyperventilate. And I said, well, I think I've just hit you, but only very, very slightly. There was not even a scratch, not on our bumpers, not anywhere. And he said, no, we have to call the police. I said, why? I can fill in a form. And he said, no, because there might be some invisible damage.
Yes.
And I said, I couldn't stop from laughing. He said, invisible damage? I hardly touched you. And you're talking about invisible damage. Where? He said, yeah, maybe behind the bumper, maybe behind there. And that's also something you really touch upon in your book, that basically people are made afraid, are frightened by the possibility of things that might go wrong, which haven't been proven
right,
that they actually might go wrong.
It's what I call possibilistic thinking.
Indeed.
It basically means that if anything can possibly go wrong, it will go wrong. And that's actually a very dangerous way of thinking.
Yeah.
Because if you always expect the worst case, then that might seem like, very cautious, and very sensible, but it could have damaging consequences. I mean, that's, President Bush, when he went to war, argued that we haven't got time to wait for the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot wait until there's a smoking gun. We have to do something now before it happens. And that becomes a way that you go to war. And we argue that, for example, even about climate change, people say, well, we cannot wait until the ice caps melt and before the whole world is destroyed. We've got to do something now. And we do that with children. We cannot wait until they're kidnapped.
Mm-hmm.
We must not let them on the streets. We've got to do something now. And that idea that you've got to fight this unknown speculative danger out there becomes the way that we behave. And the sad thing is that we end up behaving and acting in relation to what we don't know rather than what we do know.
Yeah. And it seems to immobilize people, because they become passive. They give up. They say, we can't do the thing. We won't be helped. We can't help it. So it develops into towards a culture of fear, but also a culture of passivity. I mean, people give up. They don't do anything more. They don't see the challenges, the possibilities of growth, for instance.
Yeah.
So it has a very negative effect on people and society.
Yeah.
That's what you're stating.
It is, because I think the most exciting thing in Europe over the last 400 years was the fact that people believed in the future and their ideas were future oriented and believed that the future could be a better place than life now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what inspired people to go out and do stuff. Whereas today, we tend to think that it's no point. It's only going to be a problem if you try to do something. And therefore, instead of seeing the future in that kind of positive way, we kind of hide in the present. We have a very strong presentist sensibility, which closes all kinds of options and means that all the wonderful potential we have for making things better isn't really being used in the way it could be.
Yeah, and this presentism is also part of the problem, I think, because you project things from now onto the future, so you think, right, I better give up. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It is, and if you go to a cinema, mm-hmm. it's impossible to watch a film where the future is presented in optimistic terms.
Mm-hmm.
It's always, you know, aliens invading us.
Doom.
It's always yeah. doom and gloom, as you say.
Yeah.
It's not a very nice place, this future. So uh-huh. if that's how we think of the future, then who wants it? Nobody wants it. It's more something you want to prevent from happening.
Yeah. And do you think this coincides with the rise and the shine of books that are called self-help books? That you are taught how to deal with your own life, how to deal with relationships, how to deal with your boss, books for dummies.
Yeah.
So people are regarded as dummies, and you have to read books to actually deal with life,
yeah.
to cope with just ordinary life.
I think you're right. I think the culture of fear leads to what I call the professionalization of everyday life,
yeah.
where virtually everything you do, every relationship you need enter into, mm-hmm. requires professional intervention.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of you being able to work out problems for yourself, there's a book written about how to, you know, brush your teeth, or mm-hmm. a book written about how to get on with your lover,
mm-hmm.
or a book written about how you what you do when you go on holiday. And
yeah.
not only are these books written, but you also have, especially in America, a new group of experts who will take you shopping and tell you what clothes to wear. A new group of experts that tell you how to parent, mm. how to be a good father. A new group of parents, experts that will tell you how to furnish your house. And what you're left with is a situation where you more or less treat like a child.
Mm-hmm.
It does lead to the infantilization
yeah.
of human beings, because they become really subservient to the expert who tells them what to do.
Yeah, we treat it as autistic people.
Exactly.
We have to deal with the world and
that's right.
try
we
to cope with it.
We're just too stupid to do it on our own.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why there are so many consultants, coaches,
yes.
counselors, advisors. This is also a new thing. You also actually say this, and that there are maybe how many thousands of counselors in Britain only?
Well, there are more counselors than rats in Britain, basically. Yeah. You have a situation, seriously, you have a situation where, you know, anywhere you go,
uh-huh.
you're told you need counseling.
Yeah.
Or you would, and or sometimes they would tell, if you tell them, well, actually, I'm okay, I'm feeling really nice,
mm-hmm.
they say, well, counseling can still benefit you, because you might be able to use it when you go to your workplace and you talk to your boss or your workers. And
mm-hmm.
therefore, you get a situation where you have consultants and counselors almost, you know, demanding your attention and competing for your attention, and almost implying that unless you use them, you're in denial.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
This is very Freudian, by the way.
Well, I think that's an insult to Freud. You know, I think even on a bad day, Freud was at least intellectual enough to understand
mm.
that there's no formulaic solution to personal problems.
Mm.
You know, whereas these days, you have counselors that give the same answer to everybody.
Yeah.
It's like this talk of a script that tells you you're in denial. You
know? Yeah. But also, the other thing is that people actually go to counselors, consultants, and they actually say, well, at least we had a consultant or a good advisor, and probably it won't do any harm. So it's almost the absolute belief in placebo effect. Like a consultant yeah. might be a good placebo, so it might help, whatever.
Or people go see a counselor or a consultant
mm.
as a way of bypassing taking responsibility.
Yeah, indeed.
Because
yeah.
you can always say, well, you know, it wasn't me, but it was the consultant or the counselor that said this is what I should be doing. So it's a way of distancing yourself from your problems
mm.
and not having to work out your own solution.
Yeah. But the result seems that people become very, very dependent of all things outside them, but they become very unfree and almost not independent enough to actually deal with life.
Yes, I think that's right. I think it diminishes the aspiration for independence.
Yeah.
And you can see this particularly with young people. As more and more young people live at home,
mm-hmm.
as more and more young men, for example, believe that they should be like children mm-hmm. when they grow up later in life. And in America, you have a situation now where 1/3 of the audience of Cartoon Channel are men between the age of 28 and 34, where you almost like kind of regress to childhood and delay the the point at which you say, well, I'm not a man, not a boy anymore. That kind of becomes a part of much later part of your life.
Yeah. As a result, they become even more pampered. And how will they ever deal with life?
It's a bit of a problem when you live with mom and dad.
Yeah. Don't you think there's also a financial cause for this? Well, apart from just a social or sociological cause?
Well, a lot of people argue that the reason why more and more people are living at home is financial, because it's very expensive to live elsewhere. I think that's wrong. I know, for example, if you look at real incomes are no less now than they were in the 1970s. But there's one big difference. You know, when I grew up in the 1970s, we used to live sometimes five or six of us in the same apartment. And we didn't mind sharing everything, and even the same toilet, you know, so we all had together, because we didn't want to live at home. Mm-hmm. Anything was better than living at home, even if it wasn't a very nice place to live in. Whereas today, that aspiration for independence is gone, and therefore people don't want to just leave home for the sake of it. Yeah. In fact, they're worried about leaving home. I think that's what's changed, and we give it an economic or a financial reason, whereas in fact it's a cultural, social one.
Yeah. And indeed, I think you're putting it very correctly, that it's the aspiration for independence seems to have vanished.
I think so. Yeah. Even things
like... And it's a crying shame.
The thing that I'm worried about is, I don't know about you, but when I became 18 or 19, many of us would take a bit of time off and travel around the world a little bit. Mm. And we just say, you know, tell our parents, bye-bye, I'm going off. Mm-hmm. Whereas now what they do in England, America, is they got what's called a gap year. I don't know if you got a gap year in Belgium.
Yeah, we do that.
But these gap years are highly organized. Mm-hmm. You have companies that organize gap years for children, and parents pay money for companies to, you know, organize a scheme in Chile or in Africa for their kids to go to, where they kind of volunteer for a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And it's all very supervised, and it's all done under adult, you know, sort of management.
Sort of travel agency almost.
Exactly. Yeah. So instead of the kids going off and, you know, hitting the unknown, and who knows what happens, you're where you're going to end up. It's all a big adventure. It becomes all very predictable and managed by adults.
Yeah. Yeah, and the thing is also, like, I went to England when I was maybe 18, traveled for 3 months. I left with just an address of someone in Stroud, very close to Bath. Yeah. And that was it.
Yeah.
And then after 2.5 months, I thought I better send a telex to my parents that everything's okay.
Yeah.
Because I didn't intend to travel that long. So I stayed for 3 months.
Yeah.
So then eventually, of course, my parents were just happy to see me and had to tell everything. Then now, 3 years ago, I went with some seven students of about the same age to India. And they were calling from India on their mobiles. And they were sending emails every day.
Yeah.
Then I said, well, from now on, I'm going to forbid you, I mean, almost formally, to do this, because you're here in India, not no longer in India with your parents. They couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
So this is the thing that we have developed to. There is this dependency.
Yeah.
And then my question is, don't you think it's also to do with the means, the technology that's actually there, like mobile phones, email, correspondence, being in touch with each other, like every day, every hour, sending text messages, and so on?
Well, you hit up on an interesting point. There is what's called a digital leash that parents have on their
indeed.
Children.
Yeah.
But then I think that the question is, what does that mean? You see, what's very interesting is that if you take a mobile phone, most children use a mobile phone to communicate with one another. A lot of parents give a mobile phone to children to keep an eye on them.
Yeah.
And what most children normally do is that, you know, when they go out at night and they see mommy is calling, they turn the phone off.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way they kind of avoid the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But so therefore, if they wanted to, they could get rid of the digital leash quite easily, because you know, it works two ways. You know, you don't have to email, you don't have to get the phone call. But the very fact that that's what they want to do indicates that they've been educated into a certain relationship where their lives is one where it's so intertwined that the idea of breaking free is seen as being perverse, as not something that you're interested in doing.
Yeah.
And I do meet a minority of young people who are not like that, you know, who are like almost like 60s people, and they do stand out as being very, very different, because they have a sense of adventure.
Yeah, indeed.
Which you can still see, whereas with the rest of them, it's adventure is last thing on their list of priorities.
Yeah. Don't you think this is a symptom of being sick? Because quite recently I bumped into an article, and it was quite striking because the author said, well, you should go and check this online, you can buy things on this website, and you can actually buy panties for girls and for women, so knickers, and there is this, there's a chip in it, and it a sensor.
Yeah,
and it's with GPS.
Yeah,
so your children or your daughters, they can go to parties.
Yeah,
and as soon as things start to heat up a bit too much, you can call them because and say, "Come home now."
Yes,
and it was a kind of cultural revolution thing, and then you can actually buy it. And then it said that there have been like 20,000 hits, and so many sales, and I go like, "This is really sick." My parents started to spy on the heat that has been produced in the knickers of their daughters.
Yeah.
So they call them back. It's and then my question is, aren't we sick in this way?
Well, I think that's
mentally.
I think that's an extreme example. I must write that story and use it myself.
Okay.
Sounds very interesting, because what normally happens is that parents use technology to supervise their children, and they use GPS technology. They use webcams in schools and nurseries, which is really bad because it makes it impossible for the two generations to trust each other.
Mm.
And I think that there is a kind of sickness is maybe the wrong word. There's a kind of an obsessiveness.
Yeah, maybe that's
where you where you cannot imagine that your children or young people can do anything that is not dangerous.
Mm.
And what they really are saying is that every childhood experience is potentially life-threatening, and they need to be keeping an eye on you for that reason. I think that's what's so worrying when you have such a kind of narrow, pessimistic view of childhood.
Mm. Yeah. Well, and another example that's in my previous school, when I was a kid, we just did exams, you got your marks, and that was it. Now I bumped into a new teacher, she's working there, and she said, well, at the end of the year we have to make doubles of the exams, the written exams, we have to photocopy them. And that takes quite a lot of time into July, so that into the summer holidays. And I said, why do you do this? So because every now and she said, because every year we have an increase of how do you call this, parents who sue the school.
Yeah.
And then ask, well, why do they do that? Because they believe they have been maltreated, because they have been, because they believe the teachers cheated on the children, on the pupils, with the exams. So they said, we make doubles because if we give them the exams to go to take them home and check it, sometimes they won't return them, and then they come with a lawyer and tell, like, look, the exams didn't take place, or you can't prove it. And then I feel that this also ties up with what you're actually saying. So people try to control things, but people also believe that they can just buy things.
Well, there is that, but ultimately it's about a lack of control, because what you're saying as a parent is that you're so worried about your child that you can't take their eyes off of them. And what's happening increasingly is a lot of parents are forced to go back to school, because when their child goes back to school, they're so much intertwined with what their child is doing that they end up in a situation where they check their homework very carefully, they read the reports very carefully. If a child does really well, then that's a statement about how well they've done. If a child fails, that's an indictment of their parenting. So in many respects, it's the complete loss of control that leads parents to this ridiculous situation where they end up becoming the enemies of the teachers and having all this kind of conflict.
Yeah. So it's actually the fear of loss of control.
Kind of, that's right, And where control becomes so important, the matter of life and death, that you just cannot relax and ease up.
Yeah. And do you think we can actually restore this, help this? Do we have to do something? Do you think parents can do something? Schools can do something?
Well, at the moment, not. At the moment, the trend...
You're riding the wave.
It's kind of from bad to worse. And I've noticed that every year it gets more ridiculous, and schools are a very interesting place, because you know, when you go to a school these days, what parents are interested in is not, you know, whether it's, you know, they teach you really well or what they ask you. Is it a safe school?
It's a safe school, indeed.
It's a safe school. And you know, I remember I've got an 11-year-old boy. Went to a new school with him, And every school we went to, the teacher said, Mr. Ferreira, this is a really safe school, don't worry. And I said, actually, I'm not interested in that, but you know, can you teach him to read? Can you, you know, is there good literature here? Good math teachers? Mm. And he kind of looked at me as if, you know, what's kind of going on there?
Mm.
And then you realize that they become so obsessed with safety themselves, because that's what the parents are kind of demanding, that things are going to be sliding downwards a little bit more. But I think that in the end, you know, human beings still got this desire to rebel, to kick up, to imagine, to create. And in a sense, what we need to do is to get people who are still robust and strong to kind of wage a cultural war against these kinds of trends. And, I'm convinced that if we can, in a sense, rescue a more humanist outlook about the world, then a lot of people, especially young people, will be attracted to that. Because who wants to live with their parents until they're 35, 36? I mean, who wants that dependent relationship? Who wants to be sick all the time?
Mm.
I mean, who wants to be identified through a medical diagnosis rather than what you achieved? I think so. There is, I think, potential there, but I think the issues do need to be addressed.
Yeah, I think they're watching us.
We are. Hi, hello there.
It's spying on us.
Yeah.
Hang on. Give me another question. Just now I bought a book.
Uh-huh.
And then I thought maybe I should confront Frank Furedi with this book. It's written by Paul Hawken,
uh-huh.
Blessed Unrest. And basically it's a very optimistic view on the world. He's actually saying that if you're dealing with ecological problems, economical problems, social problems, you can actually do something about it. And I think the main statement, I haven't read it yet, but what I gathered from reading certain bits is he's saying that people can form smaller networks of people within their own home countries, within city council, I mean also globally, and you can actually start doing something about it. Do you think this is a point, or does it just clash with your view on consumer activism and so on?
Well, I think there's a number of different issues. I'm very suspicious of ecological thinking because increasingly we've redefined social problems and economic problems in ecological terms.
Mm.
We can almost naturalize the problems. And quite often it leads to a situation of where we have old-fashioned Malthusianism making a return. So, for example, one of the big points that people always make is we need population control, we need less people on this planet, a kind of a biological interpretation of the problem. I'm very very distant from that, and I don't like it. Secondly, I think that small-scale solutions are never work, which is not an argument against small-scale struggles. I think that you got to begin, you know, somewhere.
Yeah.
And I'm all for people taking matters into their own hands, and sometimes even very little things that occur can set an example to others and can inspire people to also follow suit. So I'm all for people doing stuff for themselves as long as it's based upon their own experience, not people coming in and doing it for them. You know,
for someone else, on behalf.
I don't want other people speaking on my behalf, but if people are genuinely mobilizing in their interest, I think that's really positive. And the third thing, I think that the battle that needs to be fought is in the domain of culture and ideas.
Mm.
And we need to confront the ideas that support fear in the first instance before anything else can be done.
Yeah. Okay. We also have a question from the studio. Patrick, Frank Friede kan u niet meteen horen, dus probeer het. Ja.
Er was een artikel in Humo over de idlers, dat is een Engelse genootschap die bezig zijn met luieren en die een belangrijk wij kijken graag naar de werken, want daar kun je beeld van te vrienden en dat alle vormen kunnen kennen, maar de cultuur van ons die hetzelfde doen, dat alles grote schepen door de hoofdkant op die kruk, waar de hoofdkant de horizon gaat slecht. Dus het is ook een beetje de algemene cultuur.
Ja. Oh, so there is the question from the studio is that there is also, in Britain, I think, a bunch of people who call themselves the idlers. And they go for the culture of idling. And idling is just dreaming, watching the clouds, not seeing a black cloud in the sky, but just white clouds. Do you think that's a positive thing? Is that een beetje de vraag, Patrick? Yeah, he's talking about, he's saying that being afraid, it has an impact on your brain. And he's asking whether you have researched this. But it's a sort of neurological impact. But I think you're a sociologist, right?
That's right. And I think I treat fear as a cultural phenomenon that exists independently of us, but impacts upon our lives.
Yeah. So it's not ingrained in our brains.
No, I think it's something that it's more captures our imagination rather than our brain.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mr. Faridi.